Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Good morning. Andrea Bernstein in for Brian Lehrer. With us now is Peter Beinart to talk about his new book, The Crisis of Zionism. Beinart was editor-in-chief of The New Republic, currently is a senior editor at The Daily Beast, teaches at CUNY, and writes a blog about Israel called Zion Square. He was an early vocal supporter of the war in Iraq, but later came to change his tune. He's also a practicing Orthodox Jew who sends his kids to a Jewish school, but he believes Zionism is in crisis. Hello, Peter.
How are you?
Welcome back to the Brian Lehrer Show.
Thank you.
So you see Zionism as a liberal movement that came to be associated with conservative politics. In what ways do you think Zionism was originally liberal?
I think many of the founders of the Zionist movement wanted not only a Jewish state for the protection of Jews, something that I very wholeheartedly would support, but they also wanted a Jewish state committed to the Enlightenment principles that they felt Europe had betrayed. When Theodor Herzl wrote his utopian novel, Antinolant, about a future Jewish state, he had the state, the most of the novel is about a contest in this Jewish state between one candidate who wants all people to have the right to vote and one who only wants Jews to have the right to vote. He saw that as an echo of the struggles that he had seen play out in Europe vis-a-vis whether Jews would have equal citizenship, and he wanted a Jewish state that would live up to the principles that Europe had betrayed. That's why Israel's framers of its Declaration of Independence wrote that this would be a Jewish state that offered complete equality of social and political rights, irrespective of race, religion, and sex. To me, that's the miracle of Jewish statehood.
In what ways do you say it's now conservative?
I think there is a danger. There is a danger that the control of the West Bank for 44 years now, a territory where only Jews have citizenship and the right to vote, where Palestinians live under military law, violates Israel's founding ideals. And if that occupation becomes permanent, then it throws into question Israel's entire democratic character. And that's what I'm concerned about. That was part of the reason I wrote this book.
It's sort of the central conundrum, isn't it, of the state of Israel, that you have a democratic yet religious state. So I could become Israeli today since I'm Jewish, and yet somebody who has lived there for all their life and their parents have lived there could not necessarily if they live in the wrong place or they're the wrong religion. That is a paradox.
Well, that's why I think it's so important to distinguish what I call democratic Israel from non-democratic Israel. Israel within its original 1949 lines, what's called the Green Line, is not perfect. There is discrimination against Israel's Palestinian Arab citizens. The Israeli government itself has acknowledged it, but there is a foundation upon which to build. The foundation is the right of citizenship to all people, and indeed, Palestinian citizens of Israel inside the Green Line, who are called Israeli Arabs, serve on the Supreme Court, in the Knesset. That is an amazing, I think, accomplishment. It's part of why I'm so proud to be a Zionist, because Israel, under the stress of almost constant war, has still maintained that commitment to citizenship for all people inside its original boundaries. But you're right. In the West Bank, a Palestinian is barred from citizenship, and that seems to me desecrates Israel's founding ideals. I don't want to solve it by giving them Israeli citizenship, because that would throw into question Israel's character as a Jewish state, but I believe that they need the rights and dignity that comes from a state of their own.
It seems awfully hard, though. I mean, even if you took your solution and said, okay, let's have two states and let's have the sort of inside the Green Line, which is the pre-1967, right?
Yes.
Okay. Go with the inside-outside
yes.
Green Line.
Yes.
Inside the Green Line, that's the Jewish state. That's where everybody, no matter their religion, can vote. Potentially, you know, five generations down the line, do you create a situation where, okay, we're going to have to start looking about who's having more children because, you know, that is a potentially a threat to the state of Israel?
That's a great question. I think the long-term challenge for Israel within the Green Line, in the area where everyone has the right to citizenship, is to do things that inculcate a sense of loyalty and common citizenship amongst its non-Jewish population. I think Israel has much more to do in that regard. For instance, there remains significant inequities in how much money is spent in terms of housing and education and services in Israeli Arab towns. There needs to be affirmative action for Israeli Arabs in Israel's diplomatic corps, and there are a whole series of things that Yitzhak Rabin did in the 1990s that had a real impact on bringing Israeli Jews and Israeli Arabs together. So no, I don't think that you need to start counting babies in that way. What I think you can do is to move towards a sense of common citizenship while still understanding that, look, there are many countries in Europe that have crosses on their flags. Israel is not the only country that has a religious symbol on its flag, and it's not the only democracy that has a preferential immigration policy. Many Eastern European countries have preferential immigration policies. I think you can maintain those symbols and that special connection to the protection of the Jewish people and yet go much further in terms of providing full equality as long as you find a way of disengaging from the West Bank where Palestinians don't have citizenship at all.
You talk about, you know, this sort of you can't have a country that is half democratic and half not democratic. And you talk about that a lot in your book about how what happens is that it all becomes less democratic. The settlements are so entrenched that it's hard to wonder, how is there a way out? I mean, the sort of, you know, discussion of two states and dividing up the land to the pre-1967 borders seems almost impossible now, given the level of settlements on this land.
Well, I wouldn't suggest that you go back exactly to the 1967 borders. I think there need to be land swaps. This is what Bill Clinton talked about in 2000. It's what Ehud Olmert and Mahmoud Abbas were negotiating about in 2008. It's what Barack Obama talked about in his speech in 2011. So I think Israel can keep some of the settlements that are near the Green Line and give Palestinians land from within Israel's 1967 borders as compensation. The danger is that when you continue to subsidize more and more Israelis to move into the West Bank, it becomes impossible, essentially, for Israel to for the Palestinians to create a contiguous viable state because the settler population is simply so large. So, for instance, the settlement of Ariel, which is the fourth largest settlement in the West Bank, stretches 13 miles into the West Bank. That's very difficult for Israel to incorporate in the event of a peace deal because it creates such contiguity problems between the northern West Bank and the rest of the West Bank. And that's why I think, at the very least, we need to try to help Israel move towards a situation where it's no longer making it cheaper for Israelis to live in what I call non-democratic Israel than in democratic Israel.
You're not a very big fan of the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. You imply that he somehow sort of lost his connection to, or in fact maybe you say, he sort of lost his connection to the original democratic ideals of Israel. What are you talking about?
Benjamin Netanyahu, I think, has not had, as far as I can tell, the kind of epiphany that some of his predecessors like Olmert and Barak had in recognizing that Israel's democratic Jewish character required Israel to move towards a two-state solution. This is a man who ran for prime minister in 2009 opposing a Palestinian state, created a government opposing a Palestinian state, switched in June of 2009 to supporting one, but still put out a new edition of his book, which is explicitly against a Palestinian state that same year, has never made any effort to revoke Likud's platform, his party, which is explicitly against a Palestinian state, that when Barack Obama talked about a Palestinian state on 1967 lines plus swaps, which is the only kind of Palestinian state that will come into existence, he vociferously rejected that. Just this week, one of his key ministers in the Interior Cabinet, Benny Begin, said this government does not support a two-state solution. His own vice prime minister, Moshe Yaalon, said that a few months ago. So unlike his predecessor, Ehud Olmert, I don't think Benjamin Netanyahu has come to the realization that Israel's democratic Jewish character is imperiled by the encroaching of a permanent occupation of the West Bank.
He is got a lot of support in Israel. So, I mean, you know, he is now the sort of democratically elected president, as you say, you know, among those who can vote, but that is what they are choosing.
That's right. Benjamin Netanyahu has been a very successful and skilled politician. But I think, I believe that we have the right as American Jews, as Americans, to have opinions even though we don't live in Israel. We have the right to criticize the Palestinians, which I do in my book quite significantly, even though we don't live in Ramallah and Gaza City. And I think we have the right to criticize Israeli policy, even though we don't live in Tel Aviv and Sderot, especially because when you think about Israeli policy towards the Palestinians, you have to remember that this is policy being made in a context in which millions and millions of Palestinians don't have the right to vote and express their views about Israeli policy. So although Israel is a vibrant democracy inside the Green Line, I'm very proud of that as a Zionist. In fact, if all the people in the West Bank and Israel could vote on Israeli policies, I think it's fair to say they would probably not vote for Benjamin Netanyahu.
One of the things that you advocate is boycotting products from the occupied territories. Now, that seems extremely difficult to do.
Well, actually, I was inspired in this proposal, and I should say I would only support boycotting products from the settlements in conjunction with affirmative steps to invest in and buy products from within democratic Israel, because I think it's so important that we reaffirm our belief in Israel's right to exist as a democratic Jewish state. I was inspired to make this proposal by three of Israel's most famous writers, David Grossman, Amos Oz, and Aleph Bet Yehoshua, all of who have said that they would not perform in the cultural center in the West Bank settlement of Ariel. And I think as American Jews, we need to find ways of showing that we support Israel's right to exist, but supporting those Israelis who are fighting to keep it a democratic state.
There's been criticism of that proposal based on the argument that not a lot of products are produced there, that one of the products that is produced there is SodaStream, which is something that, you know, is very popular, you know, in lots of parts of New York. It allows you to make seltzer and Hava bath products, that these are sort of not products that are easy to gain a constituency to.
Well, the good news, actually, is that SodaStream is building a plant in the Negev, which is inside Israel's democratic boundaries. And I think this is precisely what we want. I don't want to drive Israeli companies out of business. Quite the contrary. What I want to do is, in contrast to an Israeli government that actually makes it cheaper often to build businesses in the West Bank, thus endangering Israel's future as a democratic Jewish state, I think we need to try to create incentives for Israeli companies to flourish inside Israel's democratic boundaries. There have been such companies. Barkon Wine moved within the Green Line. The Swedish multi-law company moved in. And I think it's terrific that SodaStream is now building in the Negev. I hope ultimately they become a company that only operates within democratic Israel. And I wouldn't boycott them because they're in the Negev, given that they now have a presence in democratic Israel. But I think we should try to create a counter-incentive for Israeli companies to work and flourish within the borders that actually live up to Israel's democratic principles.
Your book is also about the United States. And in the book, you've got a chapter calling Barack Obama America's first Jewish president. Really?
I say that because I think Barack Obama was more influenced by Jewish culture, had more close Jewish friends and advisors and political supporters than any other person who became president of the United States. Obama in the 1980s, when he came to Chicago, wanted to recreate the Civil Rights Coalition within the conservatism of the Reagan era. And he became very close to a whole series of people in the Chicago Jewish community who had been involved in Harold Washington's mayoral campaign, the first African-American mayor of Chicago. That was Chicago's civil rights movement, and who wanted to create the same coalition. And I think Obama was very taken and inspired with their connection to the Jewish tradition of the struggle for justice and human dignity. And he knew the role that Jews had played in the civil rights movement. And the Jews that he developed close relationships to in his legal career, in Hyde Park, in his nascent political career, the rabbi who lived across the street from him, Arnold Jacob Wolf, who I write about in the book, had been the private secretary to the famed Abraham Joshua Heschel, famous for marching with Martin Luther King in Selma. And I think Obama was influenced by that and also influenced by those people's connection to Israel. Those people. There's a reason that I think Obama read David Grossman, Israel's famous writer who wrote in his book Yellow Wind about what the occupation is really like, because I think Obama identified with a vision of Zionism that was connected to the social justice tradition of Israel's founders.
Those are not necessarily, you know, the Jews that he would claim now as president. you know, those are sort of very kind of the people that he was criticized for palling around with, if you will. So I'm not sure that he would be sort of happy to be associated with those particular Jews, because those Jews are not the ones who are pulling the mainstream, you know, sort of levers of power in American life right now.
I think, unfortunately, we in the American Jewish community have created an organizational infrastructure that does not reflect the liberalism of American Jewish political culture. You know, American Jews voted for Barack Obama at 78%. That's almost twice the rate of white Christians. It's higher than women did. It's higher than Hispanics. It's higher than gays and lesbians. For me, given that we are a wealthy community whose economic self-interest might lie in the other direction, and this was an African-American man with a Muslim name, I take right pride in that. Yet I think we have an organizational infrastructure that in the past several decades has moved away from the struggle for a more equal society and towards more and more focusing on a definition of pro-Israel, which does not mean solidarity with the principles of Israel's Declaration of Independence, but means supporting the policies of whatever the Israeli government does, even if they violate the principles in Israel's founding document.
President Obama has been so vilified, though, by Jews who, you know, are associated with being friends of Israel. I mean, Ed Koch really, in some ways, many people think tipped a congressional election here in New York by criticizing Obama's policy on Israel. So there's a lot of distrust there.
I think there's also a quite important generational divide that exists, at least outside of the Orthodox community, when it comes to Israel. Younger American Jews are used to have grown up seeing Israel as a relatively powerful country with a military superiority over its neighbors. They also haven't grown up seeing Israel as a refuge for Jews who had nowhere else to go in the way that older Jews have. And I think that's part of the reason that many of the American Jewish organizations are increasingly out of touch with a younger American Jewish population that wants to be able to raise difficult questions about Israeli policy, that is looking for a way to reconcile what they believe is most precious about their Jewish identity, which is, as we say around this time, around Passover, that we know the heart of the stranger because we were strangers in the land of Egypt. They want to be able to reconcile this conception of what makes the Jewish tradition precious with a love and connection to Israel, and yet they are so often shown by the organized American Jewish community essentially a vision of being pro-Israel, which says to them, support whatever the Israeli government does and don't ask any difficult questions.
You're an Orthodox Jew. You send your children to...
I should say I'm not. I wouldn't call myself an Orthodox Jew, but we do attend an Orthodox synagogue and
you
have for many years.
You attend an Orthodox synagogue. Your children go to a Jewish
yes.
school. How hard is it for you to write a book like this about Israel?
There have been difficult conversations, including within my own family, but also really amazing surprises of people who I would not have expected, who've said that even if they don't entirely agree with me, they think it's an important conversation we need to have. And, you know, I think people all over the American Jewish community are too worried about the conversations they're going to be having with their aunts and uncles and grandparents and cousins. We don't worry enough about the conversations we're going to be having with our children in 10 or 20 years if we lose the dream of a democratic Jewish state because the occupation becomes permanent. That's what frightens me. It's having to have that conversation with my children when they ask me, Baba, my children call me Baba because my son could not say Abba when he was very young. Your parents' generation handed down to you a democratic Jewish state. Why haven't you done the same to us? Why have you failed your obligation to us? Why are you making us choose between a state that is no longer democratic and a state that is no longer Jewish? I think that would be the much harder kind of conversation to have.
Thanks so much, Andrea Bernstein, in for Brian Lehrer. I've been speaking to Peter Beinert, who is the author of The Crisis of Zionism. And he'll be discussing his book tonight at 8:15 at the 92nd Street Y. Thanks so much for
coming
in.
Thank you.